Okay, I think it's working. So, today we have some of the trickier derivations that we'll see all semester. I always found these derivations really hard to remember because various tricky identities are invoked at various places, seemingly randomly. But we'll try to make some sense of it all. Just to remind you where we stopped last time, we had an expression for the vector potential, and we had decided to focus on just the first two terms. And the first term we showed is zero. It would correspond to a monopole term, which would only fall off like one over distance from a localized charge distribution, current distribution. And so this is zero because there are basically no magnetic monopoles, and you can never have a one over distance magnetic induction away from some localized sources. So now we're going to work on the next term. So let me rewrite the next term. How do I want to write it? Let me just focus not on this mu naught over 4 pi stuff. Just focus on this and work on this integral. So this can be written as also the integral of x dot x prime, j of x prime, d cubed x prime. You'll let me do that. Won't you? Yes. But before I work on it, I'm going to first derive an identity that's useful, and it's a little bit of a strange identity. The volume integral of del dotted into a scalar function f times the current or a general vector field j times g d cubed x. Start from this equation, which is by the divergence theorem, right? You can rewrite that as FGJ dotted into dA, closed surface enclosing the currents, and that is zero if we go outside of all the currents. So let me rewrite that identity as zero is the integral of the gradient of FG dotted into J plus FG del dot J d cubed x. And now the del dot j term, we can go ahead and recognize that's zero in magnetostatics, right? Del dot j plus is negative d rho dt, which is zero. And then I can go ahead and expand this gradient out. And so we've proved that this integral of del f dot j times g plus f j dot del g over the volume is zero. So that's the identity I wanted to prove, which we will use in the following. And in particular, to apply this, I'm going to set F in this identity to be the ith component of xi, x prime vector. I'm going to set g to be the jth component of the x prime vector, so that this identity reads, remember when you take the gradient of, in this case it would be the primed gradient, if we go to the primed coordinates, the primed gradient of xi prime will just be what is it? That is, yeah, it's just a unit vector in the x, in the ith direction. Sorry, confused myself for a second. And so I basically am saying this becomes the integral of, sorry, this identity is the integral of xj prime ji plus xi prime j sub j d cubed x prime, which is 0. And so now I want to go to work on this expression here. And where do I want to do that? I guess over here. So this is going to equal x dotted into the integral x prime ji d cubed x prime. If I just take one component of that, right, this whole thing is a vector because it's a scalar times a vector. I'm just going to take the ith component of this vector and rewrite it as sum over j, break it into components, xj, the integral xj prime, ji, d cubed x prime. But now I'm going to use this identity, because this integral of xj prime ji is also equal to the negative of xi prime j sub j. You have no idea why I'm doing this, do you? Oh, neither do I. It's a random invocation of a random identity, which has happened to be chosen because it works. It's really hard to remember these derivations. Anyway, so I'm going to use this fact and write this expression in a tricky way, namely, where was I? Minus a half sum over j xj times xi prime capital J sub j minus xj prime capital J sub I d cubed x prime. And where there's an integral somewhere. Okay, so I've just broken this up into two halves using this identity. And now the reason might become clear, because this now starts to look like a cross product. And that was really the goal of this derivation, that we know that this term is in the end going to have the structure of a cross product. And this is a way to get to that structure. So it looks something like x prime crossed into the vector J, the kth component. And so I will go ahead and rewrite that now, making use of this idea as minus a half sum over J and K of the Levi-Civita symbol, which after last lecture you all reviewed, I hope, in Wikipedia, if you hadn't seen before. I'll say a few things to remind you of its properties in a minute. We have epsilon ijk xj, and then the integral of x prime cross j. Let me erase this. The kth component d cubed x prime. So this notation where you have the epsilon ijk Levi-Civita symbol and two components of a vector, this is itself a cross product. And so this becomes minus a half. Now when I actually write it out in vector notation, it's x cross the integral of x prime cross j of x prime, d cubed x prime, the ith component of that. But since I think you may not work every day with Levi-Civita tensors, maybe I'll have a quick introduction to them. Which is probably review for many of you, but I could tell last time not all of you have seen these. So, Levi-Civita. I think he was actually officially my PhD advisor's PhD advisor in Italy, Ugo Fano. But I guess this is what he's most famous for, Levi-Civita. So definition, epsilon ijk is one. There are versions of this in many dimensions. We're doing the three-dimension Levi-Civita symbol. So it's equal to one if I, j, k are equal to 1, 2, 3, or a cyclic permutation of 1, 2, 3. So it could also be 2, 3, 1, or 3, 1, 2. Those are the only cyclic permutations of 1, 2, 3. It's equal to minus 1 if ijk are an anti-cyclic permutation of 1, 2, 3. Like 2, 1, 3 would be an anti-cyclic permutation that wasn't just a rotation of 1, 2, 3, but a swap of two with each other. And it is zero if two or more indices are equal, like epsilon 112 is zero. Okay. So a cross product, for instance, or a curl as well, could be written in this notation, as I wrote it over there, of two vectors A and B. Let's say the kth component you would write this as the sum over I and J, AI, BJ, epsilon IJK. And you can check for yourself that this gives the correct component of a cross product using this definition. When you are doing derivations that make use of this, rewriting the summation symbol is usually makes the derivation longer, messier, and so it's often omitted. So this is sometimes called the Einstein summation convention, to simply write it this way, with the understanding that when you have repeated indices, it's implied that they are summed over. And also, when you're working with these Levi-Civita symbols, some identities are invariably going to be useful. One of these identities is epsilon IJK, epsilon L IK prime. Actually, let me write it in a more traditional way. Epsilon IJK, epsilon IK prime L, which is called a contraction over one of the indices, because this is an implied sum over I, but only over I. This is equal to delta JK prime delta KL minus delta JL delta KK prime. This little aside is actually not in the notes until later in chapter 5. I think it's in the notes 20 or so pages later when I was using it for another derivation. With this one, you could prove, for instance, the back cab rule, if you want to try it out to see if you understand how to use these. Two other standard identities are if you have two indices summed over epsilon ijk, epsilon ijn, summed over I and J is 2 Kronecker delta Kn. And finally, if you sum over all three indices, epsilon ijk, epsilon ijk, that is simply 6 in three dimensions. Okay, enough of that aside. Let's come back to our multiple expansion. This was the main point to get to here. And in the notes, I wrote out the actual components one by one of kind of getting from here down to this form. But I'm not going to do that in on the board, I guess. But you can go through. There's a little more detail in the lecture notes, if you want to see it, and if it looks a little abstract. So basically, our bottom line is that we've proved now that this integral x dot x prime g J of X prime over volume is equal to minus a half the vector x crossed into the integral of x prime cross j of x prime d cubed x prime. And so this allows us to write a fairly simple final expression that we have for an arbitrary current loop. That's localized. We have its vector potential, which I'll call the dipole component of the vector potential at long range, long distances from the current distribution. At the point x, can be written as mu naught over 4 pi, a vector m crossed into x divided by magnitude of x cubed. And this vector m is defined to be the magnetic dipole moment of the current distribution. Defined by this integral, 1 half the integral of x prime cross j of x prime d cubed x prime. And the you know, I was just tracking that down. Yeah, where did I switch it? Oh, right. That was why. Yeah, thanks. I knew it was something like that. Thanks. So let's look now at the magnetic induction by taking the curl of this to find the general form of the B produced by the magnetic dipole term in the multiple expansion. This is, again, this is important stuff because you have lots of particles that have magnetic moments, like protons and electrons, and they interact at usually quite far away compared to the size of those objects. And so normally, this type of formulas we're deriving are what are used to tell how two magnetic dipoles, what's their energy of interaction. Okay, so we now have this general result. I think we had derived it for a very simple geometry earlier, but now it's quite general that we can take the curl of this dipole term, and it gives 3m dot n hat, right? So we have currents, there is a magnetic dipole moment M, there's a vector X, which is R n hat, unit vector in the direction of the observation point from some origin inside the currents. and it's 3m dot n hat times n hat minus m over r cubed, provided r is not zero. I won't walk you through taking the curl, but you can do that yourself if you want. But because of this problem that we have a singularity at the origin, we have to, like we did for electrostatics and electric dipoles, we have to consider that small r region very carefully. And that will end up giving an extra term. So let's look to analyze that. Let's look at the integral over a tiny sphere surrounding our magnetic dipole and see what its integral is. If we integrate this term, we saw earlier, it could be written in terms. We did the same type of analysis for electric fields, and we saw that this structure of this expression vanishes, because you can write that numerator in terms of ylms that with no y00, and so it vanishes. So this integral, let's go back to the curl expression, curl of A, volume integral over little r less than capital R, d cubed x, and now use one of the identities in the inside front pages of our favorite textbook, and we've got, convert that to a surface integral, integral d omega of n hat cross A. So now, looks like we can plug in our expression for A. So we have minus r squared mu naught over 4 pi integral d cubed x prime, j of x prime, crossed into this integral over n hat d omega over the distance x to x prime, or we've plugged in the formula for A. And now this integral, we saw back in when we were working with electric dipoles, we can write that with the expansion of this 1 over x minus x prime and write it as 4 pi over 3 n hat prime r lesser over r greater squared. And right, this is over the surface. So r greater in this case is capital R squared, and r lesser is r prime. Okay, so that takes us to here. Minus r squared mu naught over 4 pi integral d cubed x prime j of x prime cross n hat prime 4 pi r prime over 3 capital R squared. Okay. But remember that x prime is n hat prime r prime. So what we've found is that the integral of b of x d cubed x over this volume, little r less than capital R, 1 over r squared cancels that r squared, and we just have minus mu naught over 3, the volume integral d cubed x prime of j cross x prime, which is minus twice the magnetic moment. So finally, this integral is equal to 2 mu naught over 3 times m, which is the result I wanted to derive. And this holds no matter how small we make this sphere radius r, as long as it's outside the currents, assuming the currents are really, really tiny, tiny, and now we shrink the sphere tiny, tiny, it still changes, never changes this integral. So we interpret this term as implying that there has to be a delta function part of this formula. And in particular, we'll generalize this. I think already I left out mu naught over 4 pi here. So you might correct that equation. But now we're going to add to that and take away this at r naught 0 to make this general. We can add this term 8 pi over 3 m delta of x. And now we have the general formula for the magnetic induction caused by a magnetic dipole moment. I mean, this equation might seem a little weird because if you're thinking of current distributions, I mean, if there's current, one wouldn't think it's infinitesimally small normally. So it might seem a little strange, but it's going to be more relevant really not to tiny little wire loops, but it's going to be more relevant when we start talking about like an electron with a magnetic moment, which is basically a point particle. And this is, as I wrote in the notes, and as I mentioned earlier in an earlier lecture, this is a really important term to understand the hyperfine interaction. If some of you go into astronomy, it's this term which causes the 21 centimeter line in radio astronomy. There's something else we did with electric dipoles. We can, from this derivation that we did for electric dipoles, that we can also do now, which is to use the same math to make a different prediction. What is that other prediction? That we can show that if we integrate a magnetic field over a volume, and all the currents causing that magnetic field lie outside that volume, if we integrate this over a very small sphere, then this will equal 4 pi r cubed over 3 times the magnetic induction at the center of the sphere. And basically, that's just changing the role of r lesser and r greater in this derivation, is how you derive that, just the way we did So the bottom line is there are two kind of cases of interest that come out of this derivation. Okay. So case one is if you have a sphere outside of a tiny dipole, magnetic dipole we're talking now, then we have this R less than capital R of B of X D cubed X is 2 mu naught M over 3, right? This situation, this little M is here, and we integrate over this sphere of radius R. And case two is the sphere inside all currents lying outside of the sphere. So we've got like some J's, maybe some other J's. And here is our tiny sphere. And now we can calculate the average magnetic field inside this sphere of radius R, just by evaluating the magnetic induction at the center. Can show you a quick check of this formula for a planar wire loop, which is a little easier to visualize. Magnetic dipole moments, right? Current times area that you learn in like undergraduate E&M. So the formula for M applied to a planar wire loop would look as follows. Starting from the general definition, M is a half integral of X cross J of X D cubed X is a volume integral. It's not how we usually think of, right? When if you have a wire loop in a plane, you're thinking current times area. So how do we get to that? We can write this as 1/2 I, if we have a wire loop in a plane, and we have some origin somewhere, right? We can integrate, change this into an integral of I dl, so x cross dl now over the whole wire loop, which is a closed loop integral. And that is in fact simply equal to the area times n hat, the unit vector normal to the loop in the right-hand sense rule. You can check that for a circle. You make sure it agrees with your intuition about M equals I times A. The way you usually learn it in elementary physics. Okay, so this was kind of in parallel to what we did with electric dipoles. You're very amused by that result.
No, I like it when it makes sense.
Oh, yeah? It made sense?
Yeah.
Cool.
It's like guesses up, but
yeah. Okay, we can say that. It's like Gauss's law. I like it. Why not? Yeah, no, there are those aspects, yeah, that there are some universal properties, and this is how it works for magnetic fields. So one of the things that we did next, sort of in our logic of treating electric dipoles and what they, why were they important, there was a pretty big leap we made that we said when you go to now macroscopic matter, right, we have these beautiful elementary Maxwell's equations that work in the absence if we're not inside of macroscopic matter. But now when you have macroscopic matter, we found we could treat electric dipoles by saying that really matter is mostly can be thought of in terms of how it responds to an electric field as having a bunch of electric dipoles. And we turned all that into defining a new vector D. And we can play the same game, and that's what I'm about to do with magnetic fields, and regard macroscopic matter. What's different about it is it's got a whole bunch of magnetic dipoles. So let's see how that goes. We're still doing magnetostatics. We'll be coming to dynamics pretty soon, which is, I guess, a little more interesting when things are changing in time. But for now, we still have time-independent stuff. So think about what magnetic field might do to matter. We can view it as inducing magnetic dipoles M in that matter. Just like E induces electric dipoles in typical matter. And so to talk about this in macroscopic matter, we'll introduce a macroscopic measure of those dipoles. We'll introduce the magnetization analogous to the polarization vector in electrostatics, namely capital M, I'll use that symbol, as the magnetic dipole moment per unit volume. And so if you have, you know, like a collection of, say, magnetic dipoles, each with dipole individual molecules or atoms with individual particles of dipole moment M sub I, then capital M will be a sum over all types I of the particle times their magnetic dipole moment times the number density n sub I, number per unit volume of that type I. Which we assume has an M sub I, or in some cases this will be have to be averaged, like thermally averaged, or volume averaged. So now we can calculate using what we know about a single magnetic dipole moment. We can generalize the formula for the, I'll work with vector potential. Find the vector potential caused by a distribution, a continuous distribution of this magnetization density. Right, each little volume element, d cubed x prime, is going to produce at some observation point x vector x to an observation point p. It's going to produce some vector potential. And the magnetic dipole moment of this, if we have in this vicinity that we are integrating over, if we have a magnetization density, right, then there will be a differential magnetic moment, which will be m times d cubed x prime. So we can write this as a differential vector potential produced just by that little. I hate it when I break my chalk. That's very sad, but that's life. Life is hard, and then you die. It's my upbeat way of thinking about life, the universe, and everything. Yes, dA is mu naught. Over 4 pi m of x prime crossed into x minus x prime, which is actually this vector as I've drawn it, divided by the distance cubed. And this is, of course, just the dipole formula, which is mu naught over 4 pi m cross r over r cubed. It's just that formula, but now extended to a continuous distribution. And so let me rework that formula a bit. Say that again.
You should have the volume difference, the differential volume there for dA. Because you replace dm into the.
Md cubed x prime is the magnetic moment of this little tiny differential volume element, d cubed x prime.
Yeah, the d cubed x prime is not in the equation.
X prime is not in the equation.
D cube.
Oh, I need this. Thanks. I'm a little slow today. Okay. So now let me integrate that, but also rewrite it in a slightly different way. A of x is mu naught over 4 pi, volume integral of m of x prime, crossed into the primed gradient of 1 over x minus x prime, this type of replacement of this by that gradient that we've often been doing all semester. And I can't forget my d cubed x prime. And now I'm going to rewrite that as minus mu naught over 4 pi, invoking my next vector identity, kind of in parallel to what we did with electric dipoles, except we have curls now, of del prime crossed the quantity m of x prime over the distance d cubed x prime plus mu naught over 4 pi, the volume integral of the primed curl of m of x prime over x minus x prime d cubed x prime. Right? So this curl of the m over the distance, right, is going to involve, so I've basically used this identity, right? Del cross psi A is del psi cross A. What do we call that? The chain rule, essentially, in three dimensions, one form of it, plus psi del cross A. That's essentially the basis of that last integral, sum of two integrals I wrote. And now this one is the integral of a curl that we can convert to a surface integral. We can draw a surface S outside the whole medium, and we'll have m of x prime cross n hat prime over the distance x minus x prime dA prime. That's the contribution of the first term, and the second term is going to be the same. U naught over 4 pi, volume integral of del prime cross m of x prime over distance. Still a volume integral. Right, and if we go outside all the matter we're talking about here for our surface, this surface integral vanishes. But we shouldn't forget about this because we're going to come back to it later in a case where it might not vanish. But for the current derivation, it now we say it's zero. And now we can compare that formula with the vector potential expression for currents that we saw earlier. The general formula, right, A of x is mu naught over 4 pi integral of j of x prime d cubed x prime over the distance, which has a very similar looking structure. And it's saying that, it's suggesting that the magnetic dipoles just look like an extra source of current in my formula for the total vector potential. And based on that analogy, it suggests that we could define the curl of M as a type of current that we'll call the bound currents. Or to be more specific, the volume bound current density. That we can cast what all these little dipoles are doing throughout the material as effectively behaving like some extra currents in terms of the vector potential they produce. And if there is a surface current density, like in some boundary, because we're going to be, in general, needing to solve boundary value problems, need to know boundary conditions. If there is a bound surface current density, we can characterize it by M crossed the outward normal at the surface and call that K bound, which is a surface current density. And you see that then if you have some volume, it has some magnetization inside, and if, you know, maybe it's got some, for some reason, on the surface, some current, some magnetization on the surface, then that behaves as a surface current density, and the pieces on the surface now will also contribute to the vector potential at some point. And of course, when we calculate the magnetic induction, we will take, as usual, the curl of the total A produced not only by the real currents or free currents, by analogy to free charges, but also we'll include the vector potential due to the bound currents. So the curl of B which should equal now not just mu naught times the free currents J, this should be the J total, is what produces the magnetic induction, which is going to be mu naught times the actual free currents that are like in wires and stuff. Plus, we have to add the current density caused by the magnetization in the medium. And to go to the differential form of these equations, it's useful to introduce kind of the analog of the displacement vector that we introduced in electrostatics. Introduce a second vector field that is especially useful in magnetic matter. And so if we define H to be 1 over mu naught B minus the magnetization density, this is the quantity called, this is the definition, this is called the magnetic field, as opposed to B, which is the magnetic induction. Then we come to the macroscopic differential equations for magnetostatics. Still, that's all that we're doing so far. Which are del cross H is equal to the free currents only. Analogous to del dot D was rho free. And then the second equation we have is, of course, the universally true del dot B is zero, since there are no magnetic dipoles. These are the Maxwell equations in the magnetostatics realm, analogous to these equations in electrostatics. When you have matter and D was, you recall, epsilon naught E plus P. And just as we said for these equations in electrostatics, you can't solve these equations for B and or H until you give some information about how they are related. That's usually called the constitutive relation between them before you can really solve the equations. Because they are differential equations with different functions, different vector functions. But there are some reasonable approximations that often work, which we should talk about next. How to relate B and H. And just as we said in electrostatics that D in many cases is proportional to E, and I even showed how that works in quantum mechanics, in first order perturbation theory, over a very wide range of electric fields, actually, for most materials, you can also have approximate linearity between B and H. So usually that's a good starting point for most materials. To say B is mu times H, where mu is the magnetic permeability. And typical values in most ordinary matter might be, usually it's characterized this way, because mu has units of mu naught. So usually that mu naught is divided out, and you look at this quantity, how different is mu from mu naught measured this way, might typically be of the order of 10 to the minus 5. Just a very small, 10 parts in a million is this different from free space in most materials. It's interesting that you can find different signs, though, of this mu over mu naught. For mu over mu naught minus 1 negative, these are substances we call diamagnetic. and when mu over mu naught is greater than 1, these are called paramagnetic. Those are the two main classes. If I apply magnetic field to this table, unless it has iron in it, at least, or to a piece of wood, to this eraser, it's almost certainly going to be diamagnetic. Diamagnetic means you induce dipoles, sort of think of Lenz's law, opposing the field that you're turning on to the material. Third class of material is that is not linear is a ferromagnet. And there, basically, mu is just some general function of H, which is not typically not constant. And in fact, it's in many cases, it might not even be a single-valued function, but it can depend on trajectory, the path the material followed. In the magnetic field sense. So for instance, if I started here with a material and I increase H, I might get to here. But then if I go backwards, I might go some different path. This phenomenon is called hysteresis, this path dependence. And it's a typical property of ferromagnets. It really depends on the history here. Did you cool it down or did you heat it up before you started changing the applied fields to it? But the order of magnitude is of mu over mu naught could be quite large compared to this 10 to the minus 5 number I sent over there. It might be of the order of 10 to a million in ferromagnets. So it can be a huge, huge effect. Okay, I think the last thing I have time to do today is talk about the boundary behavior of these fields, which you need to understand if you're going to solve boundary value problems like you became expert at in electrostatics. Okay, so this is the boundary behavior. Let's start with del dot B is 0. Okay. We already studied del dot D is rho free to death when we were doing boundary value problems in electrostatics. Here there is no analog of rho free and del dot B is 0. And so immediately you could revisit that derivation if you like. But it immediately tells us that the normal component of B must be continuous always. Okay, curl of H equation requires a little more thought. Del cross H is J free. So that says that the integral of del cross H da, which will be the line integral around the area of an Ampérian type loop. H dot dl is I enclosed free currents only. So let's imagine, I'll try to set up the geometry, a boundary, and there's, let's say, imagine a free surface current going into the board. That's the way I've drawn it. Okay, like that. And the normal unit vector would be like in this direction. If this is medium 1, medium 2, this is n2 hat. It's pointing up into medium 2. And if I draw an Ampérian loop here, and traverse this in the right-hand rule sense. Remember, the currents were into the board, so I traverse it in this sense. And this has length delta L. And down here, maybe there's some H1. Up here, there's maybe some H2. We're trying to relate the parallel components of H, and we can do this integral around the Ampérian loop, be H2 minus H1 dotted into L naught hat, I guess, unit vector times delta L. That should equal K free times delta L dotted into N2 hat cross L naught hat. And this, L naught hat will pick in that direction. Right. So that simplifies to H2 minus H1 dotted into L naught is equal to K free crossed N to N2 hat dotted into L naught hat. But that should be true for any L naught hat, and so I can just write that equation that gives the boundary behavior of the parallel components of H to be H2 minus H1 is K3 at the surface crossed into N2 hat. Okay. So whichever H came first on the left, that has to be that unit vector. And another way to write that is that N2 hat crossed into H2 minus H1 is K3. That's maybe the more standard way to write this boundary condition. So if there's no surface current, obviously the parallel components are continuous. And if there is a surface current, they're discontinuous in this amount. Okay, that's all I have time for today. See you on Thursday.